Your entire life can change in 1 year.
Sahil Bloom, one of the world's most successful writers who's amassed millions of followers in just the last few years.
I haven't taken a day off in 10 years. My phone is either not in the room or it's on grayscale mode. I just don't give a fuck.
He's a former private equity investor turned full-time creator on a mission to help a billion people live healthy, wealthy, and high-performance lives.
The highest performers in the world, they have an innate energy for the thing that they are doing.
What was your thought process around actually making that leap?
There's this story I love of the ship of Theseus.
Why do you think you've resonated so well with people?
You have to feel like a winner before you can win.
How do you actually go build high-level contacts and really up-level your circle?
I talked to Tim for 6 months, almost every single morning.
What impact, what legacy do you want to leave?
I would love to be able to say...
Sahil, welcome to the show.
Oh man, I'm so happy to be here. It's been a long time coming, so I'm glad we're getting to do it.
6 months in the works.
I know, it's good. It's good to be here, beautiful place.
I know, we have a lot of topics to cover. I think one reason I'm really... interested in you as a human is I think you've built a world-class life. I think you've embodied holistic success, and you've actually deviated from the conventional narrative of what success is and really designed this remarkable life. And I think you've developed so many frameworks and concepts for how to think about how to maximize the quality of your life in so many areas. So I want to dive into all those. But before we get there, I want to get a little context of like your evolution and how we got here. Mm-hmm. So I know you were D1 Stanford baseball player, then you went into private equity, right? Mm-hmm. Altamont Capital, mm-hmm. $2 billion firm. You're quickly ascended into be a VP there, and then you shifted into becoming a full time writer and content creator, right? Like that is not what most people would have done in that spot. Yeah. So just walk me through your process, like. What was it that compelled you to leave a prestigious job at a multi-billion-dollar investment firm mm-hmm. and take a shot on content creation and writing?
Yeah. I mean, most of my life was sort of defined around my own insecurities. And this may be something that people can relate to, but I would just say most of my childhood, and even up to the point when maybe I was like about 30, I was pretty deeply insecure. And if I like really trace that and dig away at it, I think a bunch of it was driven by the fact that I was sort of the like ne'er-do-well son. So I have an Indian mother and academic, you know, Harvard professor father. And so academics were really important in my household. I have one older sister. She was like the golden child. Always got the best grades, always like did everything that, you know, an Indian mother and a professor father could want you to do. And I was like screwing around, playing baseball, not really taking school seriously. And I did fine. I did pretty well, but not up to the standards of what I think my parents expected of me. And that bred a lot of insecurity in me and a lot of, like, honestly, resentment towards my sister in those early years of my life, only driven by my own just discomfort with the fact that I didn't feel like I was performing up to the expectations others might have had for me. It took a long time for me to scrub that away. And so I would say a lot of my early pursuits, academically and athletically and then professionally, were driven by this desire to have like external approval. So like people to tell me that I was great, things to like pat me on the back, achievements, whatever the accolades were, all of those things were like my entire myopic focus. So, you know, early in my professional career, it was all like, how do I get Forbes 30 under 30? Like, that's what I need to feel like I'm great, to be impressed by myself. I need others to be impressed by me. And so the baseball scholarship, like going and playing, I felt so good about that because it was like, you know, D1, like you're going and doing, you get to do the Instagram post flexing on the thing, going and taking my first job. It wasn't driven by where am I going to, you know, find long-term purpose, growth, energy. It was really driven by where am I going to get the six-figure salary straight out, because that's the big flex. Mm-hmm. And, you know, to be honest, like the first 3-4 years in my career track, I was drinking from a fire hose. Like intellectually, I found it so stimulating. I was learning a ton. It was really challenging. But after a few years, what happened was I started to realize that like my energy was not pulling me into this. And this is something you'll relate to, but the highest performers in the world, they have an innate energy for the thing that they are doing. It doesn't mean you're like passionate about it necessarily, because I think passion is a weird word, but they're being pulled into it. They're becoming obsessed with the craft, and they love it in a sense in that way. They can go and obsess over a craft over and over and over again for hundreds and hundreds of hours because they're being pulled towards it. And I saw that in some of my colleagues and some of the partners and people in the industry around. The reason they had ascended to the level they had in the world of finance and the world of private equity was that they had that innate pull into that industry. I did not have that. I just didn't care enough about money, honestly. Like, I think to be incredible in the world of hedge fund, venture, private equity, you need to love money. And not like in a greedy, weird way, but in a, you need to really care.
About the game.
Yeah, about the game, about like the deal. You know, in private equity, it's like the art of the deal. You need to nerd out over the models on like what the deal structure is, warrants, options, like all of that stuff. You need to be up at night thinking about those things. I never cared. Mm. And I probably knew that about 3 or 4 years in. And then that was the first time where I started having this tension between my insecurities of wanting to continue to sound impressive, quote unquote, to the external world. So that being a like gravitational force holding me where I was, because it did sound impressive, versus this like inner voice telling me that it wasn't for me and I needed to step off the track. I needed to like jump out of the plane and do something else. All of that came to a head for me when COVID hit. And like a lot of people, that was like this chaos that kind of got like thrown over the wall into my life. And all of a sudden I was like stuck at home. I had no social life. I wasn't working as much. I needed something to kind of fill some of that new free time that I had. And writing was that thing. Very quickly, I found that I had that insane energy for it. I was just so immersed in this. At the time, it was Twitter, and it was sort of like this surface level short form writing, but I loved it. I was like really nerding out over the process and how to make things more engaging, how to connect with people, how it was reaching more and more people. There was so much about it that I just felt that innate pull towards. And that was kind of the start of me making that change.
It's a tough transition, though, too, because you're leaving one identity behind, right, that you've used to really get all your sense of love in the world from, and sense of your own purpose and self-image. And then you're going into an unknown. At that point in time, did you already have like a good nest egg that gave you a little bit of breathing room? Or like, you know, for other people listening to this that want to take their big leap and want to go pursue that thing that sets their soul on fire, there's some level of practicality involved too, right? But what was that inflection point for you? Like, were you like, hey, I've got enough money to sustain me, but I'm just going to burn the boats and figure it out? Did you like, I'm going to work until I build up this level of a nest egg so I can have some breathing room to pursue this? Or what was your thought process around actually making that leap?
Yeah, there's a few things I'll say here. So first off, I never give anyone the advice to just quit their job and then figure it out on the other side. Like, I think if you are going to take that leap, you should be creating evidence that that leap may be successful before you take the leap. So I've always thought, like, when you want to take the leap of faith in life, the reason it feels so scary is because there's two asymmetries. You have an information asymmetry, meaning you know a ton about where you are today and nothing about what the other side looks like. And there's an evidence asymmetry. You know exactly how you can live a good life on this side, and you have evidence to prove it, but you have no evidence that you can live a good life on the other side, that you can pay your bills, that you can take care of your family, all of those things. So there's an information and an evidence asymmetry. That manifests as fear. That manifests as like this enormous gap, and there's an endless expanse of nothing in between you. So the leap is like, there's no way I'm going to make it to the other side. There's too much. I just don't have the information or the evidence. You can close that gap by closing those two asymmetries, by gathering information first, by, you know, having conversations with people, doing the research, understanding what that other life might look like, and then by creating evidence, by actually doing some work, get your first customers, go build the platform or the thing that you're going to try to do, figure out if you can generate leads for the new business idea, start the little side hustle to see if it can be real. All of a sudden, that big leap starts to feel much more manageable. It feels like you're stepping over, you know, a gap rather than having to like go leap out into the unknown. So that's the first thing, just tactically. The second thing is a much deeper point, which you referenced regarding identity. And there's this story I love of the ship of Theseus. I don't know if you've heard this one. So it's ancient Greek hero named Theseus goes off to the island of Crete and fights the evil Minotaur, destroys him, and then comes back to Athens and leaves his boat that he had taken on this trip in the care of the Athenian people. And for 1,000 years, the Athenians maintain his ship, and every year they reenact the voyage that he was going to do. Well, over that 1,000 years, the ship starts to break down. And so every year they have to replace little pieces of it. So they take out a wooden board that's deteriorating and they put in a new board. Plutarch, the Greek philosopher, later asks the question, after every single piece of that ship has been replaced with a new piece, is it still the same ship? Is it still the ship of Theseus? And it's this powerful thought experiment on the nature of identity. Like, you are changing in real time on a daily basis. I mean, quite literally, over the course of 7 to 10 years, your body replaces every single cell in your body. You are a ship of Theseus, and you're changing constantly. Mm. So that desire to cling to the old identity, to say like, oh, but that's not who I am, or I need to stay on this track because that's where I am, is actually kind of a silly pursuit, because you are a literal constant being of change. You are changing.
You're resisting your own evolution.
Exactly. You're resisting it. You're not allowing yourself to embrace that change, which is the only constant in life. The paradox of change says the only constant in life is change. And so we cling to these old identities of ourselves because we think the old identity matters. And in reality, there's no real thing as an identity. You are just constantly changing and developing and growing. And so if you start to cling to the old versions of you, if you start to cling to these old beliefs, old mindsets, if you start to cling to the old people that no longer serve you, and you're trying to hold on to that, all you're doing is disallowing that change that is actually progress, that's changing who you are as a human.
I love that story. It kind of reminds me too of another story with Michelangelo. Mm. When Michelangelo created David, he said, I just kept chipping away at the marble until David revealed himself. Mm. He just chipped away all the things that weren't him. Mm. And so that's the thing. People are like, this is who I am. I don't want to, why are you trying to change me? Mm. It's like, that's actually not who you are. A lot of that is just bullshit conditioning that you picked up. And who you are is this limitless spirit that's on fire for your mission and making a dent in the universe. And, you know, that's who you are. So it's like getting rid of all the labels and identities that you think you need to be to suffice your ego, to get fast food love from people, that validation, so you can actually step into your true calling.
Yeah. Sometimes becoming who you are is actually about unbecoming who you aren't.
Ooh, that's another way to say it. I like that. Yeah. That's exactly right. So you decided you're doing Twitter threads. You're starting to write there. You're getting some validation that people are resonating with your ideas, right? When did you decide to go all in, burn the boats? I'm going to do this at a professional level.
Yeah. May of 2021 was really the inflection point. And it was the confluence of a number of things. You know, one, it was a time when it came to a head that my wife and I were really, really far away from the people that we cared about most. And you said at the beginning, you know, like sort of redefine what success looks like. And we had to have the hard conversations about that. What did a successful life look like to us? Because we'd been operating under this default assumption that a successful life meant making a bunch of money and sounding impressive to other people. And I have a dear friend named Chris Pronger, who's an NHL Hall of Fame hockey player, like one of the most storied hockey players of all time. And he gave me this piece of advice once saying, being impressive to others is overrated. What's not overrated is being impressive to yourself. He's like, I've been super impressive to other people and been the most miserable that I've been in my entire life. And we often think that by being impressive to others, all of a sudden we'll wake up and feel great about ourselves. And it's just not the case. You can't fill your cup with the validation from other people. You need to fill it internally. You need to actually find your own garden in a healthy place. And mine in particular was not in a healthy place. Being that far away from my parents, you know, my father, who I've looked up to so much, who's been such a role model in my life, who I realized I wasn't going to see that many more times in our life with the life we were living. And, you know, I had this realization that I was going to blink and wake up in 50 years and wonder what the fuck just happened, what I just did with my life. And my wife and I had been trying to have kids in California, and we had been unable to conceive. And after this big change that we made in our life, within a 45-day window, I quit my job. We sold our house in California and bought a house on the East Coast. Within a week of making that change, my wife got pregnant.
Wow.
And in hindsight, I look at that and I say, what more evidence do you need for the idea that your energy and feeling like you're in that flow of life impacts your physical reality and your physical world? And, you know, now there's science that shows that your stress levels and anxiety and all of these things impact your fertility. And so I can understand it. It makes sense. Like all of a sudden, all of these bad things in my life were pulled back and I was able to express myself in a true way. And my life changed and our life changed. It's been the most beautiful, you know, gift and blessing that we've had. But making that change and just ripping that Band-Aid off, that was May of 2021. And it really came through my wife giving me the courage to go and do that. I mean, I honestly was terrified. I don't have an entrepreneurial bone in my body naturally.
Really?
I mean, my dad's an academic, you know, he's a tenured professor. It's like the least entrepreneurial track you can have. It's the most stable job in the world. I've never, you know, my definition of success in my family would have been like going and taking a job at McKinsey and working your way up to partner and then being a partner for 20, 30 years or Goldman Sachs or wherever, replace with stable track job.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea of me building something on my own, I honestly just didn't even think about it. I thought we would move back to the East Coast and I would go take a job at another investment fund that looked sort of similar to the one I was, and that would have been my life. And my wife said to me, I was having no luck getting other jobs. Like these other funds just didn't really understand why I was writing on Twitter. They didn't really get how that could be valuable, or they thought that it was like an ego thing, whatever. It wasn't good. And my wife said to me, can't you just do this thing that you're doing on the weekends? Can't you just do that full time? Like, can't you, you're building some little businesses around it. Like, can't you just do that? And I had just never thought about it. But it was like she had gifted me this courage of, oh, she actually believes that I can build something, that I can make something of this,
wow,
what I'm doing. And it's a reminder to me now in hindsight that sometimes all you need in life is one person to believe in you before you believe in yourself. And that can be the tipping point that then you look back on and you say, wow, that was literally all I needed, was that one person that had that belief in me. And then everything that follows is a byproduct of that one belief.
So you don't think this would have happened without your wife?
No, zero chance.
That's incredible.
Yeah, zero chance. I mean, it wouldn't have happened with my wife. It wouldn't have happened with several lucky things along the way. But my wife, I mean, she's been in the trenches throughout.
For a while, since what, 15 years old?
Yeah, I was 15. She was 14 when we first met. Yeah.
That's wild. So when you first started this, if we fast forward to today, you've got millions of followers, subscribers, to, like, consuming your ideas today. You're having a massive impact in the world, right? I think, at least from the creators and writers that I've followed, you seem to be like the fastest growing and most popular person. You're actually bringing amazing stuff into the world. A couple of years ago, I doubt you would have thought it would have gone this way, right? But when you first started, what was the mission with the content? Because there's a lot of people out here that want to build brands. They want to do content. They really are craving to have a bigger impact in the world and share their voice. They're like, what the hell do I write about? What's my mission? Why am I doing this? Like, when you were starting out, what was the mission that was kind of your North Star?
Yeah. I mean, the first thing was, it was really around finance. It was, if you recall, like May of 2020 was when I started writing on Twitter. That was the most confusing time maybe in our lifetimes in markets, because the entire economy was shut down and markets were ripping. Like, everything was going up and to the right, but literally the economy was shut down. Everyone was at home. No one had a job, and yet the markets were going up and to the right. And I had all my former baseball friends who viewed me as like the finance guy, because I was working in finance, texting me saying, dude, what the hell is going on? Can you help me understand? What is quantitative easing? What is money printing? Like, what are, they were asking me all these questions. So I would literally take the questions they were sending me, and then I would sit down and try to distill that to explain it to a five-year-old, was basically what I thought. And my insight at the time was, there's a lot of people that are doing the like Lamborghini explanation, trying to make, you know, themselves sound smart. They do all the jargon and acronyms and, you know, here's the complexity around macro that's all going on, which goes over most people's heads. And then there was a bunch of people that were doing the like really cheap version, like TikTok, telling you to YOLO into call options of GameStop or whatever, like here's how you can make tons of money. I kind of thought like, wow, there's a real room in the middle for the like Toyota Camry answer. That's like, I'm just going to give you the like straight talk, layman's terms, deliver this in a way that anyone can understand, so that my friend, like, and I would test it on my baseball friends. They don't understand anything about finance. Do they understand the way I just explained it? And I would use parables. I mean, I would use allegory. Like, it was using storytelling to help explain a concept that typically is very academic. And I knew I didn't want to write about finance forever. but that was kind of the entry point. And that was also the lesson that I learned from that was stories are what drive all of this. Being able to tell a concept by using a story, by using metaphor, that is how you bridge to action. We were talking about this before. Mm-hmm. There's so much information out there. And most people will consume the information and then go on living the exact same way. So my insight was, how can I deliver the information in a way that makes the bridge to action much easier for people so that they can go do one tiny thing that makes their life a little bit better? Because if I'm the catalyst for them to make their life a little bit better, they're going to keep coming back. Then that's someone I've earned their trust now that I made their life a little bit better. They're going to come to me and trust me. And the last thing I'll say there is, I think a lot of people get into the idea of building a brand based on vanity, right? Mm. It's based on, I want to build millions of followers and do this and that. And what I thought from the beginning was, it's not the size of an audience that matters. What actually is the important factor is trust, because commerce follows trust. Throughout history, commerce follows trust. Trust used to be owned by a handful of large conglomerates that owned all the airwaves. They owned TV and radio and magazines and all the ad space. And so you trusted them, so you would buy products from them, the like P&Gs of the world, right? Mm-hmm. Johnson & Johnson, all these enormous conglomerate companies. Well, now we're in this process, this arrow through time, where trust is being decentralized. Trust can actually be built by me sitting at my computer at home creating content on the internet. And if I can command that trust, then commerce will follow. I'll be able to build businesses on the back of it. I'll be able to do things on the back of that trust. But if I don't have trust as the primary motivation, then I'm going to build an audience and there's going to be no trust. They're not going to know who I am, and there's going to be no commerce that follows that. So from the get-go, I really focused on what can I be doing to build trust with these people. And that means taking a really long-term approach. It means doing things the right way from a place where I would want to consume the content that I'm actually creating.
You gave me some really good, maybe the best advice I've gotten on content at our last dinner. I don't know if you remember it, but I'm like, cool, if I'm building a brand, what should I be keeping in mind? You're like, look, you can either build content as this character that you've created, or you can build content for yourself that you're genuinely passionate about, that you're just excited to share with the world. If you do the character thing, you might build this brand, quote unquote, but you're going to burn out. Maybe 2 years, maybe 3 years from now, you're going to get tired of trying to fulfill this content of this character that you created instead of what truly is you. And if you can just figure out a way to express what authentically makes you come alive and figure out how to communicate that effectively to the world, you're going to want to stick with it forever. And it's going to be really who you are. Mm-hmm. And that got me thinking too, because like with this podcast, we have a lot of, you know, billionaire founders and a lot of massively successful business people. But when I thought about it, I'm like, the question I asked myself off the back of your conversation was, if I had 1 year to live, what messages must I share with the world? Because that would probably be a lot less about business content and more about life content, more about how to help people actually build world-class lives and find spiritual fulfillment and create lives that set them on fire, right? And so that was a really key moment in my inflection point in how I'm actually building content.
Yeah, I love that. It's a really good question to ask yourself too. Like, what message do I feel I need to share with the world?
You know, because there's so much. And you talk about health, you talk about wealth, you talk about high performance habits, but they're all things that go back to who you are, which is just a high performing person who wants to master himself and maximize the quality of every area of your life.
Yeah, it's hard to do too. It's easy for me to say that to you. And the reason most people don't go act on that advice is because it's a much slower, longer term game to play.
Yeah.
I mean, I think about it with my own content. I would grow much faster if I picked a niche and I just hammered that over and over again. If I was just the money guy and all I did was just talk to you about, here's how to make, you know, here's five ways to make $10 million with seven income streams. Like, that video would probably blow up. It would also be total bullshit.
Yeah.
But if I picked a niche and stayed true to it, if all I did was running or health content, I mean, like, it would grow faster, but it wouldn't be unique to who I am as an individual. It wouldn't be authentic to who I am as a person. And I wouldn't be able to do it for the next 30 or 40 years. And I don't want to do things that I'm not able to do for the next 30 or 40 years. That doesn't mean I'm definitely going to do everything for 30 to 40 years, but I don't want to start playing a game that I'm not willing to do for that long. The other way I think about it is there's two types of people, especially in the world of brand building and content. there's these two types of people. There's people who are a salesman of the idea, and then there's people who are a product of the idea.
Okay.
And there's a huge difference between the two. A salesman of the idea is the actor. That's the person that's just like, you know, pitching, talking, yeah, all of these things, but they're not about it. They're not actually about the idea. They're like, yeah, they're going to make money off the seminar teaching you how to flip houses, not flipping houses. And then there's the product of the idea, the person who is actually living the thing that they're talking about every single day, where you're like, if you went and observed them for a week, every single thing they say and talk about on the internet is literally how they're living their life. They're documenting how they're living their life and they're sharing that in real time. Which one do I want to be over the long term? And which one can I reliably do for the next 30 or 40 years? I can't be a salesman of an idea for 30 or 40 years because it's fake. It's fairy dust. The number of people who have done that successfully, you can probably count on one hand. And eventually the chickens come to roost, I would argue.
Yeah.
Products of the idea, that's forever. That's an infinite game, if you will. Like, people can do that and be a product of the idea forever because it's who you are. It's actually how you're living on a daily basis. Like, when we've talked about it, you know, the cold plunge habit. Like, when I do content about cold plunging, it was a fad, it was a trend, people are doing all these things. There's always someone yelling like, oh, you're just doing this for likes. Like, no, I literally do this every single morning. You just happen to be there with me because I have my phone on it or I have a video camera on me. Yeah. I'm not like, when I started on YouTube, I was literally filming myself for 4 or 5 minutes, raw, uncut, unedited, in the cold plunge talking. I did it every single day for like 150 days. They got no views. Like, it wasn't like they were blowing up on YouTube, right, but I was going to be in the cold plunge either way. So turning on the camera made no difference to me. It just didn't matter. But that was who I actually was. It was just how I was living.
That's a fucking awesome distinction too. I think building a brand is a spiritual quest of really figuring out what parts of yourself do you want to express to the world. And there's external and intrinsic driven people in that regard. One wants to gain the most amount of followers and attention so they can feel important. The other one is using it as a vehicle to create a superior version of themselves that they're excited about. It's about the internal evolution. And you're saying, hey, that is the product. I'm just a guy who genuinely wants to evolve and I'm gonna bring you on the journey with me. And there's just no salesmanship about that. And like, I think that's one of the reasons why you blew up is like, this guy is just like himself. He's not trying to sell shit. He's not trying to project someone who he's not. He's vulnerable, authentic, and he does inspiring shit every day. Right? That like, I think people can get behind. But I'm curious from your angle now in 2020 hindsight, I imagine you've looked at this because your results are pretty asymmetric. Why do you think you've been so successful? Why do you think you've resonated so well with people?
You know, I tend to think that one of the things that I've done differently, at least, is I've tried to avoid answers, and I've focused a lot more on questions. And what I mean by that is social media and content in general is saturated with people telling you exactly how to live your life, with telling you if you don't eat this way, you're an idiot and you're going to have low T, or telling you, you know, if you don't do this workout, you're going to blow out your knees and your back's going to get hurt, or telling you if you don't follow this way to make money, you're going to be poor the rest of your life. And that's stupid, right? There's a million, I mean, like, we're sitting here, there's a million freaking ways to make money. There's a million different ways to, you know, pursue a healthy, successful life. And so me telling you one way and you have to do this, it might be good for likes and engagement in the short run, but it's not real. It's not actually, there's no one size fits all approach to life. What I would much rather do is talk about the questions that I'm wrestling with on my journey that have helped me improve my life incrementally over these last few years. And I can do that reliably because I'm constantly wrestling with different questions. There's only so many answers that I have. Like, right, my answers to you, if you were like, hey, how do I get in shape? My answer would literally be like, move your body for 30 minutes a day and eat single ingredient, whole unprocessed foods. That's not super sexy. Like, that's not complicated. I'm probably not going to get that many likes on saying that because it's super boring. I can't just say that over and over again. And even that would be my answer. That would be the thing. So what I try to focus on, what I've done, is what am I struggling with on a daily basis? Like, what are the things that I find tension, or stress, or anxiety around? And how can I share my own journey to navigating those stresses or anxieties or change? Like, how can I share my approach to how I thought about taking that leap of faith in my own life? How can I share my approach to trying to get better at failing at things and learning through those failures? That's what I wrestle with, and that's what I'm trying to get across in the content that I create. I'm not trying to share that I have all of this stuff figured out. Like, I hope it comes across that I'm in a process of figuring out. I'm not in the like figured out, oh, I've made it, everything's great. I've figured some stuff out, but for the most part, I'm just right alongside the people that are following me on that same journey of learning as I go.
It reminds me of Naval's quote, escape competition through authenticity, right? And that is a beautiful mind frame too, because that just eliminates imposter syndrome because you're not posturing.
Yeah.
So where's the imposter syndrome? You're like, hey, I've figured out some shit. I've had some success, but I'm still on the way. I'm going to solve problems in real time, create little blueprints that I myself probably want to follow and share them with the world. And I think that's powerful.
I like that a lot. It's, you know, the challenge is it's not a track that has, it's not a path that has a really clear path.
No. Right?
Like I went from the career track I was on that had, you know, 20, 30 year time horizon. I knew exactly what I was going to be doing. I knew what level I'd be at. I knew what would happen to a high degree of certainty, to a path where I really have no idea. And if I spend too much time thinking about it, it stresses me out. I mean, in general, I have found that stress and anxiety are a function of the amount of time that you spend living in the future and living in the past. When you're living in the present, you actually have no stress and anxiety. It all melts away. You're right there. That's why getting into a cold plunge, you don't feel stressed or anxious, right? You're present. You were freaking cold. You're right there. Or in a workout, you're right there. You're feeling it. That's why those are such healthy practices for people, because they force you into the present in a real and visceral way. When you feel stress and anxiety, pay attention to what you're thinking about in that moment. It's either that you're worrying about something you did in the past, or you're worrying about something that could happen in the future. When you center on the present, you don't feel that. And so I am wrestling with constantly that of how much time am I spending concerning myself over 5, 10, 15, 20 years in the future versus just taking actions today that are going to leave me a little bit better off tomorrow.
I like that a lot. If you're talking to someone right now who is building their brand, they're sharing their content with the world, and they're like, so how do I know I'm doing the right things? Like, what are a couple tips that I should be keeping front and center as I'm building my brand and trying to create this authentic, high value content?
I would say number one is, would you consume and find value in the content you're creating? What I asked you, that's my heuristic or razor for every single newsletter that I write. You know, I've written 2 newsletters a week without fail since May of 2021. Haven't missed one. And every single time I ask myself that, would I want to read this newsletter? Would I leave this having learned at least one thing that I could use in my life? And when the answer is no, I literally go rewrite it. And that's happened. Like, I'll write something and be like, ah, this is just pandering. You know, I'm just like, I didn't feel inspired, and so I just pandered. And then I have to go back and redo it. And most people wouldn't do that, right? They would just hit send. You're like, oh, I got to get something out. Too bad, it's out. But I really take that seriously because, again, trust. It's very, very hard to build, and it's very easy to lose.
That's a great – just to highlight that real quick, it's an amazing question, because when you have 800,000 subscribers, I imagine that's a bit easier because you're like, wow, a lot of people are going to read this. This has got to make sense. But – to ask yourself that question and hold that level of standard when you have 10 subscribers, you're like, hey, I could just send this out. I only got 10 subscribers. But if you treat those 10 like they're the 800,000, that's how it works.
Yeah. I mean, our friend who we talked about earlier, David Senra, who runs Founders Podcast, it's one of the best business podcasts out there. He talks about the fact that he creates every single podcast as though he's talking to one person, one listener. Like, he thinks of the hundreds of thousands of listeners as a single listener. And he just thinks about, like, is this person going to find this insanely valuable, what I'm doing and how I'm creating this? And that's like, you know, he's maniacal, obsessed with what he's doing. I probably can never aspire to be the level of obsessed that he is with his craft. But I can distill that insight into something that actually does drive me forward in that way. The second piece of advice I would give is, again, it's centering yourself around the present day quest And with the actions that you're taking today, if you repeat them for 100 days in a row, are you going to be better off or worse off than you are now? And I've always found that to be a really healthy question to ask, because it centers you around what you can actually do now, rather than worrying about, you know, the 10-year plan, the 5-year plan, the 15-year plan, all of these things. Mm. I find it to be like one of the dumbest things to do, to spend time worrying about 10 years in the future. I want to worry about, what can I do today that leaves me slightly better off tomorrow? And then I'm going to do it again, and then it leaves me slightly better off. And if you can center around that, you can make dramatic, dramatic improvements. I mean, your life in a single year, your entire life can change in 1 year.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, it's truly, truly insane how much. I mean, you're talking about it. Like, how long have you been building this business?
4 years.
Yeah, 4 years, right? It's like dramatic change in your life. I've been doing this since May of 2021, so a little over 3 years.
COVID, same time.
Insane.
Yeah.
Insane how much your life can change. And like, yeah, now I reflect on it in the broader life change. I'll be like, sitting with my wife and, you know, like our backyard, our son, we're playing with him. And I'm like, just so much gratitude for the change that can occur over a short period of time. We think that it's going to take 10 years to make a big change in our life. It can take one. You can be in an entirely different place in a year if you are willing to have focus, discipline, effort every single day.
That's where I think it is, man, because at least in my opinion, I think the closest thing to a limitless pill is a stack of good habits, right? I think the most successful people that appear extraordinary or superhuman have just habit stacked and are so consistent with those habits that they've just created a character that can transcend any goal.
Yeah.
They can do anything because they've mastered themselves, right? And I feel like that's big for you, right? Like, you're looking at your mental game, your physical game. I'm curious for you, what's one thing in the last few years, a habit or an idea that you've implemented in your life that was so beneficial for you that you're just like, shit, why didn't I do that 10 years ago?
I have several. I agree with you, by the way, just on the premise that, habit stacking too is, there's not like a 5-day work week on habits. People are like, oh yeah, well, I was good. You know, I was good during the week. So now on the weekend, I'm going to let loose. That's not how it works. People come and they're like, you know, oh, I want to do what you do, or I want to, you know, be really successful. I want to do this thing. And then I see them on the weekend doing whatever the hell they want, sleeping in, doing this, doing that, not going to work, right? Oh yeah, because I worked 5 days in this week, so now I'm going to take off on the weekend. That's fine. And you can build a good life that way. But if you're truly ambitious and you want to go achieve something exceptional, that's not going to work.
Right.
That's not how life works. You do it every single day. I haven't taken a day off in 10 years, but it's not because I'm like a hardo, because I'm like, oh, grind till you stop. Like, I don't say that on the internet. I just really enjoy the things that I'm doing on a daily basis. And I want to keep doing them because I know what that's doing for my life. Mm-hmm. And I've built in the rest into my day-to-day life where that I don't get burned out. I have the recovery just as much as the push. The habit, I would say there's probably two things. One is sort of like an upper, and then the other's a downer, I suppose, if you will. So my morning cold plunge has been probably the single greatest life hack that I've experienced over the last few years. Every single morning, it's how I start my morning. I'm up at, you know, somewhere between 4:15 and 4:30. And the first thing I do is get into the cold plunge. It's right on my deck, 3 to 7 minutes with my thoughts or making some sort of video or something to put out. And the difference in my focus, energy, cognition, mood is dramatic. And I've now A/B tested it because I did a month without it to see what it was like and to see if I could feel a difference. Mm-hmm. And it's dramatic. I have no idea whether any of the purported health benefits are real, like all the things about brown fat and metabolism, all of those. I have no clue. I don't care. If they're real, I view it as upside. Upside to all of the mental benefits that I experience as a result.
Yeah. And that, before we go on to the next one, I want to highlight this because there's so much flack around cold plunging. Everyone's like, oh, I just got my cold plunge. Am I a millionaire yet? Like, there's all this like entrepreneurial hustle porn around how you got to do all these ridiculous habits.
You might be though. You might. Right?
But the funny thing is this goes back to a concept that we can dive deeper on, is voluntary struggle, right? And if you want to accomplish something remarkable in life, you have to develop a resilient mind, and you actually have to train your nervous system on how to handle abnormal amounts of stress, right? And so for me, like that, when I started the company, I was afraid, right? I didn't have the experience. I was running out of money. I wasn't in a great spot when I started my company. I wasn't secure. And I was like, all right, well, I got to be harder than anything I face. So I went through this regimen, 5 a.m. every day was cold plunging in 31 degrees. Mm-hmm. And I did that for a year, and I just became this, it gave me a psychological edge. And it forces you to sit in there and actually breathe through things and recondition your nervous system to feel comfort in massive amounts of stress. Mm-hmm. And so that directly translates into a very key attribute of what it takes to be a successful entrepreneur. And so for me, like, cold plunging and making millions of dollars are directly related. Mm-hmm. You know, so people laugh at it, but I'm like, no, you're actually, you have to go through a process of character development. Mm-hmm. And things like this that you talk about, there's no loser that wakes up at 5 a.m. and works out, right? It's character development. Mm-hmm. It's building yourself into this person that is so strong you can overcome any obstacle, and that permeates every area of your life.
Yeah, I mean, you have to feel like a winner before you can win in general, in anything, right? You have to, like, have that mindset that you are a winner before you actually go and win. It's like, you don't just go, a lot of people say, like, well, Kobe had a winner's mentality because he won a lot. It's like, no, he had a winner's mentality, and then he went out and won because he had convinced himself that he was a winner. Like, he created this pool of evidence that he was a winner in his mind and then manifested that in the real world. And I just think of waking up early, working out, cold plunging, very, very hard things that the vast majority of people will not do, that start to convince yourself that you're a winner. And so, like, I had a 24-year-old come to me recently and ask what he could do to improve his standing in life. The first piece of advice I gave him was to wake up early and work out. And he was like, what? No, I'm talking about making money. I need to make more money. I was like, you don't understand. This is one action that you can start your day with, that you are entirely in control of, that's free, that will start to convince you, start to build that pool of evidence that you're a winner. And then you'll start to see that, the ripple effects of that in the real world. But it starts here. You use it as a catalyst into everything else. So I have viewed that cold plunge habit as a catalyst that has ripple effects into everything else throughout the day. You start the day and you feel like a badass. You feel like a winner. You feel like a savage. And when you feel that way, you're not going to go screw around. You're going to go sit to your desk and you're going to be a badass. You're going to be a killer. You're going to be really laser focused.
Yes.
And if you start your day that way, it's hard to lose. I mean, when I say that there's no such thing as a loser who wakes up early and works out, I really mean it. It's hard. No one Netflixes and chills at 5 a.m. when they wake up. People Netflix and chill at midnight when you're up late, but no one does it in the morning because it's freaking hard to get up and get out of bed. So you're not going to get up, get out of bed, and then watch Netflix. It's just stupid. No one does that.
And dominating your mornings is how you finish the day typically, mm-hmm. right? So you're setting up your day for success. You're building momentum. Yeah. But you're right. It's the feeling of winning. Mm-hmm. And Kobe also said what what brought his confidence was preparation. It was the work he did in the gym 4 hours before anyone showed up for practice. Mm-hmm. It was all that great. And that's what created the psychology to then go out there and be a dominant force in the world. And I think people really don't look at this enough. To your point, they're looking for the book that's going to teach them how to make the money. Mm-hmm. They're going to look for the shortcut, the silver bullet. But if you can just develop and build yourself, mm-hmm. I really do think that's, like, the foundation to be able to transcend any goal.
Yeah, you have to stop getting your dopamine from information gathering.
We just talked about this too offline. It's like I was telling you, I really believe that learning only occurs once you have produced a result. Mm-hmm. If you have not produced a result, you have not learned anything. You have a conceptual understanding of something, but if you want to prove to yourself that you actually know it, mm-hmm. meaning you embody it, you have to have physical evidence. Mm-hmm. So instead of reading books or listening to this podcast and just moving on with your day, it's like, all right, well, what was something I learned where I could practice it?
Yeah.
And then have a validating result to show me that I actually have learned it because it's existing in my life.
Yeah, the greatest people in the world have a razor-thin gap between information and action. They gather the information, but they're immediately acting upon it in some tiny way. It doesn't mean they're taking dramatic action, but they're acting on that information in some way. And as a young person, if you can work on that, if you can work on shrinking the gap between the information you gather and the action that you actually execute on, that's probably the thing that's going to have the greatest single impact in your life.
I would not disagree with that at all. Yeah. So if you're talking to someone who's kind of stuck, they want more out of life, they want to be more successful, they want to feel more successful, you'd say, hey, first off, work out, get up early, mm-hmm. start dominating your day and start stacking wins early so mm-hmm. you feel like a beast as you go through your day. Mm-hmm. Do something like a cold plunge, but really just voluntary struggle, mm-hmm. right? Do hard shit for the sake of doing hard shit to build resilience and to build that reputation with yourself. Mm-hmm. What are the other habits that you'd recommend that could have a really asymmetric benefit to someone being more successful?
Yeah, I mean, I think the other thing is you need to build a focus muscle. We live in a modern age where focus is an increasingly challenging thing to develop because I don't have my phone in my pocket on me, but every single force is conspiring against your focus. Everything is like the immediate notifications, the breaking news, the beeps, the emails, the texts, every single thing is urgent all of a sudden. And all of those things are little pulls at your attention that's dragging you away from the one thing that really matters. If you can start your day with doing the one hard thing and then with spending 1 to 2 hours on the most important thing, quote unquote, whatever that one thing is that you really need to make progress on. If you're early on in your life, maybe it's building a world-class skill. Maybe you spend that first hour like working on honing a craft before your job starts for the day, before your work that you're actually earning money, building the skill that's going to be the thing that changes your life. But you need to be focused. People think that they're doing focus work. They're like, yeah, I'm doing focus. And then they're checking their text and then they're on social media and then they're looking at an email. True focus is really hard to come by, but it is immensely powerful if you can actually execute on it. There's actually, you know, there's scientific evidence that checking something quickly is actually putting yourself into a perpetually cognitively impaired state. It's called attention residue. A professor named Dr. Sophie Leroy at the University of Washington studied this. And what she found was that anytime you go and check one little thing, an email, a text, a social media, whatever, a little bit of your attention remains with that other task. So if you go do that, if I'm working on something focused, and then I go check my texts, and then I come back to work on the focus thing, a little bit of my brain is still on those texts. I'm still thinking about, oh, what did I say to Chris? What, you know, what was the conversation? What was the thing that he needed for me while I'm back focusing? So now where I was operating at 100% here on the focus task, now I'm at 90, now I'm at 80. And that compounds over long periods of time. If I'm at 100 here and I do that every single day, think about where I'm going to end up in a month versus if I'm at 80% focus every single day for a month. Dramatic, enormous, enormous difference. So avoiding that attention residue, avoiding those things that are going to pull the little bits of your attention in different directions is the key to actually unlocking that skill building, the income generation, all of those things that are essential to building that life that you want on the other side.
That is a freaking powerful piece of advice. I do think you're right. Focus is the hardest thing to come by in this world. So are there particular things you do to stay locked in and get,
yeah.
I've heard we're up to 500% more effective in flow state when we're not task switching. Are there any like rituals you have or any, I don't know, routines that you follow to help you stay in that flow state and maximize your output?
Yeah, I call this like a power up ritual. So, you know, like a computer when you boot it up, like it's like a boot up sequence that it goes through. I think maybe Cal Newport talked about this originally, which is where I found it. You know, he's like the king. Deep Work is an incredible book on this, by the way, if you haven't read it. Having like a fixed sequence of things that you know gets you into that dialed in state is an incredible little tool. Like if you have 3 or 4 things that you can do that kind of set the conditions for that flow state for you, then every day you're able to just quickly go through those and now you're in that state. So for me, it's I'm always listening to the same thing. So I personally really like listening to classical music when I'm in that focus. So I have the playlist on, noise canceling headphones. Normally it's a cold brew. Like I need a drink, something that's kind of like signals to me that I'm in focus mode and in that focus time. And then my phone is either not in the room in a different place, or it's on grayscale mode. So I'm a huge fan of like grayscale mode throughout the day. Anytime I'm not doing something that needs color on the screen, my phone's on grayscale mode. It immediately reduces the addictiveness of your phone.
I applaud you. I'd put that on and then I would just double click it and go back to colors.
Well, I do double click it off, but only ideally only when I like doing a video or posting something or I need to see the color.
Okay.
But having your phone not in the room is probably the best hack. It's like, it's just not there. Now it's just off my mind. And then I use, there's a bunch of apps, but I use something called Flow, which is like an app that blocks all of the things that would distract you. So it'll block certain web pages that you know you'd go to that would distract you, or certain apps on your computer, basically just as a forcing function to make sure that I can't do just the little like, oh, let me pop open email, or let me pop open Twitter, or let me pop open, because it's very easy. Like you finish a paragraph of something, you're like, oh, you get the dopamine hit. Oh, I got through that. Okay, let me, I can just take a minute. It's fine. And you walk away from it. But again, every time you do that, you're like pulling yourself away from the thing. And while I was writing my book, I really needed to force this, because every day I was like basically committing to 2 to 3 hours of focused writing on it every day. And if I started, you know, putting little chinks in that by leaving and going and doing something else, it would have really hurt that whole process.
Yes. I like that attention residue is a game-changing thought. Like every time I switch tasks, I'm literally giving a piece of myself and it's staying over here.
Yeah.
That makes me much more conscious of what I'm doing.
Yeah, and you know that that's true. Like you can think about that in your own life. You're like, oh yeah, I am a little stressed about the email that I just got that I was responding to. Right. So now I'm not present. I mean, there's a study that Microsoft did where they took a group of people through a set of meetings where they had a break in between each one, and then a control group of a group of people that had no breaks between the meetings. And what they found was they put EEGs on all of them to measure their brain activity. And what they found was that the people who had breaks saw no stress buildup across the set of 4 meetings, versus the control group who had no breaks had this incredible buildup of stress in their minds. In addition, the people who had breaks performed better in every single meeting. And the idea was the people that had no breaks were still thinking about the last meeting, or they were worried about the next meeting when they had the back-to-backs, versus this tiny little 5-minute break allowed you to create discrete blocks of focus where you didn't see the stress build up and you were able to be present in the meeting, not be worrying about the last one or the next one. And that allowed you to perform at a higher level and not feel the stress during the day.
I'm going to implement that, because I'll go on 4 or 5 hours of back-to-back calls and I'm like, just no time to reset.
25-minute meetings.
25-minute meetings.
25 minutes instead of 30 minutes. You give yourself 5 minutes.
I like that.
And you avoid, what I found happens is that you just avoid the like useless banter that starts most calls. So like you don't have to do the whole like, oh, it's hot in Miami this time of year. Like, no shit. It's August in Miami. It's hot. we don't need to talk about it. It's okay. You get away from the banker talk. You don't need to do that.
I love that. That's a good little tactic to deploy immediately. Huh. There's this other idea I think that you embody well, of progressive overload, right? And like you do that in the gym, but you also can do that in your life, right? And it's just in the gym, you're obviously a big fan of that. It's like, how do you get stronger? You increase the resistance that you're lifting, and over time you break down muscle and you build it back up, because you're progressively overloading, and each week you're taking on a little bit more. You're getting a little bit better, 1% better each week. And if you apply that to your life too, you're tracking yourself, you're looking at certain habits, and you're just, you're intentionally looking at how you're growing in every area. So I created this habit tracker where I have my 7 top habits and I track them every single day, and I have a score at the end of the week. So it's a game, right? But I'm saying, hey, what are my biggest goals in life? And what are the habits, the behaviors that I think are most likely to lead me to those goals and those results? And how can I just track those, knowing if I just keep dribbling and shooting and do these, that the scoreboard's gonna take care of itself, right? And so what I realized, we talked about identity before, like identity change is just behavior change. If you want to have a new life, you need to become somebody new. And that's just fundamentally changing your behaviors. Mm-hmm. And so it's just interesting looking at life. It's really just a matter of creating an identity that aligns to who you want to be and then backing it up with behaviors.
Yeah. Well, I love that. And one of the most challenging things that a lot of people face, a question that I constantly get, is as you start making those changes, there are going to be a lot of people that don't like that.
Yeah.
People from your past life, your past identity, the people that you accumulated, they might not like when you are pursuing this change and trying to become different and changing who you are as a person. Mm-hmm. And what I've always said is you are not responsible for how your self-improvement journey makes other people feel.
I love that.
You are not responsible for that. If it exposes their insecurities about the fact that they are not on that journey, that they're not growing in those ways that you are not responsible for that. And so you don't need to feel bad. You don't need to change. You don't need to lower your ambitions. You don't need to pull back on the journey that you're on simply because your journey is making someone else from your prior life feel insecure about what they're doing on a daily basis.
Have you gotten like hate emails or DMs of people that used to be close with you that are like, oh, you're too cool for us now, Sahil? Like, have you had to go through that period yourself?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that is, I would say that is probably one of the most common and unfortunate realities of, I don't consider myself successful, quote unquote, but of starting to achieve success. One of the harsh truths of success is that most people don't want you to be successful. They want you to achieve success up to the point where you're more successful than them, and then they want to just knock you back down. And it's sad. It's a really sad thing. And you go talk to a bunch of really successful people. Every single one of them will give you examples of that exact thing happening. And it's one of the saddest things, and it's why success can be really lonely. Because sometimes what happens is you are changing, you're making those changes in your life, you're living a different way. The people that were in your life were from that past identity of you, the ship of Theseus analogy that I gave earlier. Like, they are from that past version of you, and you haven't found your new people yet. So as a result, you are changing, you're losing those people from the past, and you don't have the new people. So it's lonely. You're going to be in a place in your life where you don't feel like you have the people that are aligned with who you are as a human being and where you're going. Mm-hmm. And what you have to do is you have to have faith that your actions and the values and the things that you're doing on a daily basis are going to be a magnet for the right type of people. You're going to attract what you're putting out into the world. And if you want to find those people, if people ask, how do I get into rooms with the type of people that I want to become? Become the type of person that you want to become, and you'll attract those people.
That is one of the most important conversations that could be had. I think that stops people from achieving greatness and living the lives they want, is they feel this sort of commitment or loyalty to people just because they were part of their past. And as we both know, like, you do become the five plus people you hang out with the most. And what you just said spoke to my soul, because when I was 25, 26, I was going out four nights a week drinking. All my friends just went to clubs, right? And so I just got sick of it and said, something's got to change. These people aren't going where I want to go in life. And I said, don't let substances substitute substance, right? So I was like, if I'm just hanging out with people for substances and there's no actual substance in our relationship, then I'm cutting them out. And so I stopped drinking, I stopped going out, and then I went salsa dancing, and I decided to pick up a sober skill set and make new friends, and I met one of my best friends who changed my life in doing that, but I had to rebuild 99% of my friend group. I maybe have one or two friends that I knew from 10, 15 years ago, you know, but that's the reality. You have to be more committed to your vision of who you want to be and the life you want to live than the people into your past just because you once had some sort of friendship agreement.
Yeah, and you're real... The real people that you want that are going to be in the trenches with you will support that. Yes. They'll see that you're changing and they'll want to love you and support you for that. I mean, you're like, if you have, I think it was Tyler Perry had this idea of three types of relationships in your life. There are three types of relationships. There's leaves, branches, and roots. The leaves are seasonal. Like, they're there when it's nice and sunny. And then when the wind starts to blow and it gets colder, the leaves fall off the tree. Branches are a little bit more stable and can last, but you need to make sure that you don't put too much weight on them. You can't like trust that they're not going to break off and fall off the tree. And then the roots are the people that are truly there from beginning to end. They're like wide and deep and they're really entrenched in the ground. And the whole goal is that you find those few roots in your life and that you become roots to someone else. And if you want to attract more roots into your life, go be someone's roots.
God, that's one of my favorite metaphors I've heard.
I love that one.
That's really good.
It was him as the Madea. I don't know if you knew like Tyler Perry's old stuff. Like, he had this like Madea alter ego character that was like his wise old aunt or something like that. Yeah. And it was from that.
Oh, that's funny, man. I love it.
Good, yeah.
So I guess now, like, I think everyone has heard the quote, "You are the five people you spend the most time with."
Yeah.
I don't think many people actually think on it deeply enough. So like when you're at this point in this evolution of who Sahil is, when you're looking at the people that are in your inner circle, the people that you trust in the most, confide in the most, take feedback from the most, like your core people, like what are the attributes and types of people that you now surround yourself with that you wish you could have told your younger self, hey, get around these type of people?
Look, I constantly think about the marshmallow test as an adult. You know, in the 1970s, Stanford professor takes these kids, puts them in a room, puts a marshmallow on a plate and says, I'm going to leave and come back in a few minutes. And if you don't eat the marshmallow, you're going to get an even better treat when I come back. Some of the kids obviously couldn't resist and they ate the marshmallow. And then some of the kids waited and got the better treat in a few minutes. And what they did was they followed the children over the course of their lives, and they found that the kids who delayed gratification, the kids who waited for the better treat in 5 or 10 minutes, had better health outcomes, better, you know, test scores, better education outcomes. They lived better lives because delayed gratification was embedded in who they were as humans. As I think about the one single value that is a common thread across the people that I love spending time with, it's delayed gratification. It's the willingness to do hard things now to experience great benefits later. You know, there's this common saying that the best things in life are free. And I think it's bullshit. The best things in life are extremely, extremely expensive, but the currency to acquire them is not money. It's effort. It's energy, it's intensity, it's consistency, it's working on those things on a daily basis. It's the willingness to delay gratification, to build your body, to build your mind, to build a house full of love, Naval Ravikant's quote. Those are the things that are the greatest thing in life, and you can't buy them. Jeff Bezos can't get those things any better than you or I can. And that is what I'm now focused on. So when I find people who are aligned with me in those values, and a lot of times it comes through people who really are committed to their health. Because I know when someone's committed to, you know, like this morning, I wanted to go out for a run. And I like post saying I'm going out for a run. And a handful of people show up to go run 6 miles in the hot, humid air. I kind of fuck with those guys now. Like I met them for the first time, David. I'm like, I kind of know you. Like, you're my guy. Like, I know a lot about you from the fact that you just showed up at 5 a.m. to go for a 6 mile run. And that to me is a filtering mechanism. Again, it's like, it's a marshmallow test for adults. I'm now learning a whole lot about the type of person that someone is as a result of that.
You mentioned, yeah, it's great because you want to be around people that have attributes that you also admire, right? And because we have mirror neurons in our brains and we automatically mirror the people closest to us, you want to make sure that those people have good habits, they have great mindsets in how they view the world, they operate in a way that you're like, I want some of that too, right? And together you create this force field, this like vacuum of awesomeness, and you collectively you can achieve amazing things together. And you talked about this too. I think this is an important topic to cover. In order to really thrive, at least in my opinion, and create an exceptional life, the quality of your relationships is the foundation of that. It starts with yourself, and then based on how well you view yourself and how great you are in terms of your alignment to your potential, that determines who you attract into your life, right? But like having even a handful of amazing people that are aligned can just produce in and of itself the most exhilarating life, right? But people want to figure out, how do we close that gap? They're like, right now I'm drinking, right now I'm stuck in this job that I hate, I'm in this toxic relationship, and like I want to get better friends and I want people around me that really inspire me and support me and motivate me. But at that point in time, they're not the person that those types of people, right, would want to be around. And so when you think about that almost esoteric idea of like, well, just upgrade yourself, right? Like, what's your thought process for doing that? Is it like make a list of the habits that you'd want to be surrounded by in friends? Or how do you think through telling people, hey, if you want these type of people, how do I actually close that gap?
It's probably the number one piece of relationship advice I give people, which is sit down and make a list of all of the values and traits you want to find in your ideal partner, and then go out and actually embody them yourself. And I can't tell you the number of friends I have who are single and are trying to meet someone, and they tell me this long list of things they're trying to find in a woman. And they don't embody a single one of those things. They're like, oh, I want someone who's trusting. Like, dude, but you're the first person to go through your girlfriend's phone. Like, how are you going to find someone trusting if you're not trusting? Right. How are you going to find someone that is into fitness if you're not into fitness? How, like, all of these things it's easy to find the things that you want in the world if you are living by those things in your own life. It's one of my favorite quotes. Don't waste your time chasing butterflies. Mend your garden and the butterflies will come. And I think it's true in all areas of life. If you are living that way, if you are putting that energy out into the world, you're going to attract that energy back into you. And it's not woo-woo, and it's not me saying like, oh, there's all this energy floating out in the ecosystem. It's literally because you are going to put yourself into environments where those things are naturally occurring.
Yeah.
If I'm putting myself into environments that where I'm surrounded by people who care about their health and their well-being and who care about improving themselves because I'm at gyms, because I'm at farmers markets, because I'm at dog parks, because whatever, because I'm at, you know, self-improvement events and dinners, I'm probably going to find a lot of people that are into health and wellness, that are into health, that are into, you know, like all of those things. It's going to naturally attract that into your world. So that's the number one thing I think is like, if you want to find something, then be that yourself and you'll start attracting that into your world.
What's your take on networking, right? A lot, I get asked this question a lot too. Mm-hmm. And I was the most awkward networker like early on in my career. Cause like, I just wanted to win people's approval so bad. And I walk into these events and see these speakers on stages and all these awesome people I admired at dinner, but I wasn't able to build a relationship with them because I was putting them on a pedestal, right? And there was this cognitive and energetic dissonance between me and that person that you can't build an authentic relationship, right? So in my experience, you kind of have to feel comfortable within yourself and see yourself as an equal to everybody to build genuine relationships. But also, like, you kind of have to build something exciting. Like, sometimes people are so focused on networking, but they have nothing they're working on. They have nothing interesting about them. And they're just trying to get their success through the affiliations with other people. And so what I learned, I'm like, shit, like, why didn't I just focus on building something awesome that naturally would have the butterflies come to my garden, right? But I'm curious when it comes to networking and building high level contacts, because I mean, you've been mentored by Tim Cook, the CEO of Apple, and Bill Ackman. You've met some incredible people. What's your advice in that scenario? Like, how do you actually go build high level contacts and really up level your circle?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's two pieces. One is networking has a connotation of being transactional. And it is very, very obvious to successful people if this is someone that wants something from you. You know, you mentioned Tim. Like, I talked to Tim for 6 months, almost every single morning, before I knew who he was. He was one of five people that happened to show up at the gym at 4:45 every morning. I was in my first job. I wasn't in tech. I didn't know the tech world. He was a new CEO at the time, so he wasn't as famous as he is now. He was just one of the five guys that showed up at the gym super early in the morning. And I talked to him every single morning. And now we joke about it and laugh about it. Like, I didn't know who you were. And he, I know, could tell that it was like we were just talking. I wasn't looking to get a job at Apple. I wasn't trying to do something. I wasn't looking for an investment. And every single person that approaches someone of that stature is looking for something. And so you can stand out by simply being someone who isn't looking to gain something from this relationship. You're just looking to learn. You're just looking to be genuine and create value however you can. So that's the first thing, is genuine over transactional is the number one way to stand out in any networking context. And again, that is a marshmallow test for life, because transactional means short term. It means I'm looking for the dopamine hit right now from this person investing in my startup, from this person giving me a job, from this person giving me money, from this person connecting me with someone else, versus the willingness to say, I'm going to just build a genuine relationship and let life happen as it will. And I would be willing to bet that some great things happen in the long run from these relationships that are built, but who knows what they are? I'm not ever going to ask. That's number one. Number two, you have to create value in some way. So you say, like, go build something. I totally agree with that, because I think about my life before and after making this big change. If I had stayed on the track I was on, you know, just working in finance, I'd probably be, you know, a junior partner now or whatever it is. I wouldn't be remotely interesting to any of these people. And that's not a knock on myself or the type of person I was, but I just would have been on a very standard track, and I wouldn't have built anything or really created anything. I would be on a path, and I would be, you know, able to sound intelligent about it, and I probably would be remotely financially successful, etc. But I wouldn't have done anything unique. And so now I get invited to things because I'm doing something different. I'm probably not going to be as rich as I would have been if I'd worked in private equity. I'm probably not going to like have as cool of a title or whatever it is, but I'm doing something different. So people like having people around who are doing something, who are building something that feels different, who can have slightly different conversations. Mm-hmm. I don't need, you know, like Bill Ackman, if he wants to talk to someone about finance, he's not talking to some random junior partner at a private equity fund, right? Like he's going to go call whoever, right? He's going to call Warren Buffett and have a conversation with him about finance. He's not going to talk to me.
Exactly.
But I might be doing something pretty different. You know, if I'm writing a book and I, you know, maybe he's thinking about writing and we can have a conversation about that. Or if I'm building businesses a slightly different way, he might be interested. And so we can have a conversation then. Not as peers, I still admire him and look up to him as like a totally different level than me, but we can have a conversation on an entirely different plane than if I was coming in there as like, you know, some finance guy that's looking for a job at Pershing.
Right.
It's just a totally different environment that I've put myself into by just doing something different.
And I think why you're able to attract those level of people too is like, I think if you look at the core attribute of a lot of those people, they're like operating at the fullest expression of who they are. Right? They're like unleashed into the world. And when you're boxed into this job in private equity that didn't suit you, you're kind of this diluted version of yourself. And now you have a mission, a cause that is true to your soul. Like you're operating and vibrating in your highest frequency and the highest expression of what you do. And people are very attracted to that energy because you experience life in such a beautiful, exciting, enthusiastic way. And I think that's very also underrated is like genuinely just building a life that you love. Mm-hmm. So you radiate enthusiasm and positivity because most billionaires I know aren't the happiest people. Mm-hmm. And who do people want to be around? They want to be around people who experience life the way they want to experience it. And they're like, wow, look at this guy on his mission. He's just thriving. He's got crazy energy. Like, I like that. I want to be around that. And so you don't even need some sort of number in your bank account to build $1 billion network. It's like, do you have a mission and a vision you're excited about? Is that contagious? Can people feel it? They're like, wow, I see me and you.
Yeah. The other thing is like the number one thing a lot of those guys are now thinking about is health.
That's
like you see
true.
All of them getting fit now, right? Like Zuckerberg and Bezos and all these guys are like getting really fit and focusing on biohack and all this stuff. So they love talking about those kind of things. So if you're into really health and fitness, you actually already have something to offer to a lot of those people.
Yes.
I also... Look, I pardon my French, I just don't give a fuck. Yeah, like, I don't care who you are. I don't care if you're Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos, Tim Cook. Like, I don't give a fuck.
Yeah.
If you are a kind, genuine person, and you're contributing value to the world, and you're intellectually curious, and you're engaged, like, that's what I care about. I don't care if you're at some, I'm not scared to have a conversation with them. It's a human being. And it's one of the most liberating things in the world, actually, is once you spend time with a few people like that, you realize they're the exact same as you. They're just a person that has executed on an insane level, probably had some lucky breaks, and is going and building something amazing. People know who they are. They're not different. Like, they're just another human. And I'm going to treat them that exact same way as I would treat you, as I would treat my employees, as I would treat people I work with. It literally doesn't matter to me. And if you're a dick, and you're really successful, you're a dick. Like, I don't want to hang out with you. I don't want to be friends with you.
Absolutely.
And I'm not gonna bow down to you.
Yes.
And you might not like me. That's okay. But like, I treat people based on how they treat the world and how they treat me as a human being, not because they're rich or successful or what they're doing. And again, I don't think a lot of people in success that have achieved that level of success have that many people that they encounter who treat them normal.
You're so right.
They get treated like gods that are just walking around on air. And you know, like one of my dear, dear friends is he works with one of the most famous celebrities in the world. Like, you know, probably one of the most 3 to 5 recognizable people in the world. A guy that could go anywhere in the entire world and get mobbed on the street. And this person did something bad. And every single person in their life was like, hey, it's okay, buddy. You're good. Like, you know, don't worry about it. You're going to bounce back. Everything's fine. And my friend was the only one who was like, no, dude, you're an idiot. Like, you did a really dumb thing. You have to pay for what you did. And it wasn't a legal thing. It was a personal thing. But he was like, he held him to account. And a year later, all of those friends who patted him on the back are gone. And my friend is now like his dearest, closest confidant because he was the only person that was able to like shake him and just say, I'm going to be a truth teller in your life. Like, you're not getting the coddled celebrity treatment from me. You did a stupid thing as a human being and I'm going to treat you accordingly. And you're going to have to pay for it in the way that a normal person would. You're not getting patted on the back. And I just think that is so rare. As you achieve more and more success, there's a tendency for everyone around you to just pat you on the back and smile and be like, hey, good job, buddy. Yeah, you're totally right. That's a smart decision. Mm-hmm. It's the reason a lot of people get too close to the sun and then come crashing back down. Like the Icarus paradox, right?
Yeah.
You know, as you get higher and higher, no one wants to tell you the truth. No one wants to say the hard thing to you because it benefits them to just stay close to the, you know, to the king and just like pat them on the back. And not having those truth tellers in your life as you continue to rise is really dangerous. So anyone on that journey that is rising, for you, for me, anyone, making sure you have those people in your life who can tell you the truth about these things, who will treat you normal, is a really essential antidote.
That actually kind of goes in line with your delayed gratification premise too. Mm-hmm. Like they're willing to have a more uncomfortable conversation with you in the short term to have a better long-term relationship with you. And you know, and so it's being able to do short-term difficult things, whether it's doing a hard habit or having a difficult conversation.
Yep.
That's, I love that, man. You have a couple, concepts that I really, you have a lot of interesting ones. There's a couple that really hit me that I was like pondering for a while. And one of them was, I think it was Nietzsche's, eternal recurrence. Mm. I believe you called it. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah. So this was this idea that a demon comes to you in the middle of the night and basically forces you into this condition where you are going to have to live your exact life over and over again in an eternal recurrence, in an eternally on repeat, exactly the way that you have currently lived. Would you, if that were to happen, find that to be horrifying or affirming of the decisions that you've made? And it's a thought experiment that forces you to zoom out and think about the decisions you're making and the way that you're living your life. Would you be happy to continue to live the exact life that you have today and continue to live in that eternal occurrence? Or would that be something that you would view as horrifying, that you need to make changes in order for that to be affirming? And it's like a very quick way to just sort of cut through the noise in your own life and think about that fact. Like, would I be happy living this over and over again? Or do I need to make changes now in order to get to that point?
Yeah. I think what screws people up, and I probably fall into that loop too, is just thinking you have time, right? You're like, well, if I was living the same year every year for the rest of my life, I'd want my wife, right? I'd want to have spend more time with relationships, but I'm in more of a business building phase right now. But I'm like, it's just a point in time. And then eventually I can sequence it out and have more time for this later. How do you reconcile those where it's like hard to do everything at once?
Yeah.
You know?
I tend to think that when we tell ourselves we'll do things later, we're never going to do them.
Yeah.
And so you need to, like, it's the, you know, from Shawshank Redemption, get busy living or get busy dying. You need to make a choice in the present. I certainly agree with you that there are a few phases of life. I particularly think in your 20s where you're in a foundation building season, where if you do the right things and you compound knowledge and you compound some financial gains, you can set yourself up for a degree of comfort later in life that is important. I don't think that means that you sacrifice all of the deep relationships in your life and that you just don't talk to people. I've always thought that people spend way too much time on the breadth of relationships and not enough time on the depth of relationships. You actually need way fewer friends than you think. I'm not in a phase of my life where I want hundreds of friends. Like in college, I like wanted to be everybody's buddy. I wanted everyone to like me. I would much rather have 10 people that love me now than have thousands of people who like me. I just don't really care. And like, so I'm not going to go to network. I mean, you and I met at like a big group dinner. I don't think I've gone to a big group dinner since then because you couldn't pay me enough money to go to a dinner like that. I hate the like, you got to go around the table and say your name and introduce yourself. I'm like, my energy just goes to die. I mean, I'm glad I met you there, but like, I can't stand that kind of thing because I'm not trying to network and get hundreds of phone numbers or cards. Like, I just want to meet a few people that I can really be in the war with and in the trenches with.
Yeah.
And that doesn't take that much time. That takes some energy that you need to be able to commit to those people for the depth, but it doesn't take, you don't need to be going out every weekend with those people, seeing them all the time. Your deepest relationships, it's not about the flashy shows of relationship connection. It's about the tiny little things. It's about the like letting them know what they mean to you, about being there for them if they have that fall or they're down. That's what actually goes a long way towards building those.
You're so right. It's crazy because this year specifically, I came to the exact same realization. And what really struck me when we met we exchanged contact info. And I'm like, yeah, let's follow up, do a quick Zoom call. You're like, no, I don't do Zooms. You're like, if I see you, we're seeing each other in person and spending actual quality time together.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh shit, I like this guy as a disciplined blueprint for how he lives his life, because he doesn't want to have more surface level conversations. Yeah. Zoom call follow-ups after dinners. I'm like, man, that's right. I've gotten a lot of those requests too, and I don't like them either. But you're like, let's actually meet in person, spend real time together, and build a real relationship. And I'm like, that is powerful. And I spent, you know, I have the biggest network I've ever had, but I have the smallest circle I've ever had.
I mean, think about our relationship now. Like, this is the first time we've hung out in person since that dinner. If we had done a Zoom call, would our relationship be in any different place coming into today than doing what we just did? Like, now we've spent time together. We've had long conversation before this, during this. Like, now we're probably going to be homies coming out of this. Like, we know each other on a deeper level. There's a real level of connection. We know that we have similar vibes and beliefs and values around a lot of things. What are you learning about someone on a Zoom call? Like, I'm literally, most of the time you're on a Zoom call, you're like doing email at the same time because it's up on the screen, or you're seeing the text that people are sending to you. And like, for me, I actually view it as me being respectful of the other person's time by not doing the Zoom call, because I'm not going to be focused. Like, if we're on a Zoom call, I know that my attention is going to be super scattered because I don't like sitting at my computer. I sometimes will do like a walking phone call because I know that on a walk I'm centered. Like, it's the only thing that I'm focusing on. I'm not sitting on my phone. But I just honestly found that I was wasting the other person's time when I was sitting on those phone calls just as much as my own.
So you remind me of, do you know Elliot Bisnow?
No.
So he created Summit at Sea. Okay. It's like the most iconic event for entrepreneurs. It's like Burning Man for entrepreneurs on a big boat that they've done with Richard Branson for 15 years. It's a remarkable event. But we ended up becoming close after that event. And I remember I called him and it immediately shut my call down, and I got an automatic text message. It's like, if you'd like to speak with me, please FaceTime me when you're present. And like, he doesn't take regular phone calls.
I like that.
He wants you to have a FaceTime so he can see that you're present on the call.
Oh.
And
I like that.
And I think we go back to what we're talking about earlier, is like, people who live extraordinary lives are radically intentional.
Yeah.
Right. And they create codes they live by. And like, I think that's why I really learned so much from you, because I'm like, this guy is so serious about squeezing every drop out of that lemon of life.
Yeah.
And then you set up conditions to allow you to do that, and you are extraordinarily disciplined to make sure you can execute on it.
Yeah. Try to be. It's again, it's a signaling thing, right? Though, of like, there's some people that would have gotten that message from me and thought I was a jerk. And it actually has nothing to do with me being a jerk. I'm like,
it's their perspective.
Yeah.
Too, right?
And if they think that, it's probably not someone that I'm actually going to have a good relationship with anyway. And so it's like, there's actually a good filtering there.
I just looked at this guy's really protective of his time.
Yeah. Yeah. I go back and forth on it though, because I self-identify as a nice person, like nice, right? And that has drawbacks, because when you're nice, you're prone to just giving your time to anyone who requests it. And only after having a kid did I start to realize that, you know, I had this as a argument with my wife once. She was like, I was telling her that I was doing this, like, hey, saying no to Zoom calls, let's get together in person. By the way, like, anyone that comes to New York City, I'll meet with a 20-year-old kid, 24, like, I'm not just only meeting with people that I think are impressive. Like, I get together, anyone can come out and go on a run with me at any time. Lucas, my buddy, is here with me. Like, every single morning when I'm at home and I go out on my run at the same time, someone from somewhere is coming out and running with me. And because I say, like, yeah, you're more than welcome to come and join me during my routines and the things that I'm doing. It's not like I'm trying to be high and mighty when I say those things. But I told my wife that I was doing that, and she was like, well, don't be a jerk. And I was like, no, you're missing the point. Every single time I say yes to one of those things, it's me saying no to you and Roman, to you and our son, because my energy's finite. And so if I give a little bit here, 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 and here, then I'm saying no to you guys in these different ways. Then I'm not going to be with you during those windows, or I'm not going to be present because I'm going to be drained, whatever the thing is. And so that reframe has been really helpful for me, because it gives you a razor to cut through the noise to say, what am I saying no to by saying yes to this thing?
That's a great point. Then it's not so selfish, because you're doing it because you want to protect other people as well.
Yeah, or protect your business, or your health, or protect your sleep, or whatever the thing is. Like, I'm saying no to something else by saying yes to this. It's all just a trade.
Yeah, I love it. I got a few last questions for you. So we're about action, we talked about, right? Like, we both want to help people create tangibly better lives, right? Mm-hmm. You do that through your newsletter, your content, your writing. I do it through this podcast. If we had to give the world an experiment to run for 30 days, that you think a simple experiment to run for 30 days that could dramatically increase their life or their quality of life, what experiment would we have them run?
Pick one thing that you want to improve at and spend 30 minutes per day, every single day for the next 30 days, focused on it. I don't care what it is. Like if it's improving your health, go out for a walk for 30 minutes, go on a Stairmaster for 30 minutes. If it's learning a language, do that. Rosetta Stone, whatever. If it's building a side hustle, spend time researching for 30 minutes for 30 days. Whatever it is, because what I've always found, this is actually what I do, by the way, when I'm trying to start something new, I do this. I call it my 30 for 30 approach. 30 minutes per day for 30 straight days. 900 minutes of accumulated effort over the course of 30 days. Think about what you can do in 900 minutes of focused effort on one thing. It's insane. I mean, you can get a business started up. You can get it started rolling. You can get your first customers. You can learn a ton about an industry. You can start to have the makings of learning a new language. You can get in much better cardiovascular shape. You can make gains on whatever it is, you know, musculature that you're trying to develop. It's crazy. But most people won't do it. And it's such a low bar. I mean, 30 minutes, anyone can find 30 minutes in their day. I don't care how busy you are. If you want to do it, if you actually care, you'll find the time to do that. So 30 minutes per day for 30 straight days. Pick one friend that you're going to do it with and just have a text thread where all you say is just done. So whenever you finish your 30 minutes, you just text to that thread just saying done. And it can be like your tiny little ounce of accountability where you're not going to let the other person down. You're not going to let yourself down. You're going to just say done. And for 30 days, do that. I guarantee you will be in a completely different place.
Wow, that's brilliant. So it could be related to your fitness and getting more fit in the gym. It could be starting a new business, learning a new skill set. Mm-hmm. Whatever it is, mm-hmm. just 30 Coding. Minutes, 30 days, and then have peer accountability mm-hmm. with your friend. And then it might be helpful, too, to add your two-day rule. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that kind of volley is nice.
Yeah, I'm not going to claim this one because I think James Clear wrote about it first. But the idea is never skip twice. So if you're trying to build a habit, it actually, the science shows, doesn't matter that much if you miss one day as mm-hmm. long as you don't miss two. Mm-hmm. That's where the actual negative impact comes in. So never skip twice. So if you're going to start building a habit, just make sure that there's never 2 days in a row where you miss. It's okay to miss one, but never miss twice.
I like that because then you start reinforcing the old identity instead of building the new one.
Yeah.
I like that.
And even like, look, I mean, minimum viable progress is a real thing. Like if I don't have an hour to work out today, that doesn't mean I shouldn't work out. That means if I go for a 5-minute walk, that's better than zero. Anything above zero compounds positively in your life.
Yeah.
So spend 1 minute, spend 5 minutes, do 10 push-ups. It's better than doing nothing.
Yeah, I love it. That's very actionable. I love it. Yeah. Before I ask my last question, where can our audience find you online?
Everything is under my name. One of the benefits of having a weird name is that it's pretty easy to find me. So at Sahil Bloom on whatever platform, and then my website is sahilbloom.com.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Join the newsletter. It's fucking awesome.
I appreciate that. And I'll come back and we'll have a conversation about the book once it's closer.
We've got a book coming out shortly. That'll be round two.
Yeah.
I can't wait to dive into that.
Looking forward to it.
But last question. I'm curious for you, man. I know you're a deep thinker and always wrestling with esoteric questions and just trying to, again, maximize your impact in this world. So when you look at things and you're 130 years old in the metaverse in your rocking chair, right? Like what impact, what legacy do you want to leave?
I would love to be able to say that I impacted a billion lives. And the number billion is entirely arbitrary and entirely made up in my mind. I can't say there's any science behind that. But if there were a lot of people out in the world who ascribed some positive change in their life to something that they read from me, that would be pretty cool. And that would make me feel like it was a life well lived.
I like that. I think that billion number is just inspiring to you too. It's like, wow.
Yeah, it's like big and crazy and it'll take 50 to 70 years to do. You know, it's just nuts.
Incredible. But that size of the vision ends up giving you your level of discipline today, right?
Yeah.
Because if you're aiming for a goal that big, it's giving you who you are in the present.
Yeah, and it can't be done in a year. It can't be done in 5 years. It can't be done in 10 years. It's going to take 50
years. I love it. Your mindset is so fucking inspiring. I learn a ton from you every time. I mean, from your newsletter in person, I've loved the conversation. And yeah, I just got to give you an acknowledgement because there's a lot of creators online that I wouldn't say are ushering the right messages to the world to actually help people. And I feel like your heart is in the right place. I think you're brilliant, but I could just, your mission, you live the mission, man. You are so radically authentic and in integrity with your mission. And I'm like, that's the kind of people I want to be around, man. Just like, they can't be sold. There's no number that could buy you. You're just raw and so in alignment with who you want to be and what you want to create. So I think it's incredible. And I hope more people listen to this, get inspired to master themselves, to master their habits, and to follow the path that they were put here to follow.
I appreciate it, man. I feel the same way about you. So glad this was the start of hopefully a long relationship.
Same, brother. Awesome.
Awesome.